Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, November 24th, 2020. Opinion. National View. A victory for courtroom access in George Floyd case. The Point. Judge's decision to allow live stream is a well-reasoned call for transparency in the pandemic. Although Minnesota prosecutors are unhappy about the change, Minnesotans should applaud a recent judicial decision to allow cameras and audio in the courtroom during the George Floyd murder trial. Hennepin County Judge Peter Cahill issued the historic ruling, rightly arguing that the March trial should be live-streamed because of the national and international interest in the case and the limited courtroom space and public access to the proceedings caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Last week, state prosecutors filed a motion asking Cahill to reconsider his order, reiterating objections the Attorney General's office raised in July. At that time, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison's team said that, while his office supported a public trial, the state is concerned that live audio and visual coverage in the courtroom may create more problems than they will solve. They also argued that live audio and visual coverage could alter the way lawyers present evidence, subject trial participants to greater media scrutiny, and be intimidating to witnesses, all problems that could affect conducting a fair trial. Cahill made the right call. It's in the best interest of trial participants and the public for this high-profile trial to be as accessible as possible. As Cahill wrote, the only way to vindicate the defendant's constitutional right to a public trial and the media's and public's constitutional rights of access to criminal trials is to allow audio and video coverage of the trial. The trial for former Minneapolis police officers Derek Chauvin, J. Alexander King, Thomas Lane, and Tu Tao will be closely followed. Chauvin is charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter in connection with Floyd's May 25th death while in police custody. The others are charged with aiding and abetting him. All four are free on bail. While many other states have permitted cameras in the courtroom, Minnesota has rarely done so. The Star Tribune and other news media organizations have long advocated for greater public access. In making his decision, Cahill made the case that cameras can be allowed in such a way that protects the rights of trial participants, for example, by not showing the jury, and the ability of the news media to provide live coverage. He cited both the First Amendment guarantee of press and public access to trials, as well as the Sixth Amendment guarantee that the public may see that defendants are fairly dealt with and not unjustly condemned. Social distancing requirements during the COVID-19 pandemic have restricted courtroom access, Cahill noted, and for the Floyd trial, those constraints would allow little, if any, room for families and friends of Floyd and the officers, as well as the public and news media. Cahill's ruling is well-reasoned and fair. Minnesotans should hope it will lead to greater access to the state's courtrooms even after the pandemic has passed. The Minneapolis Star Tribune. Trump's crazy electoral college scheme. The Republican Party has lost in the popular vote for president in 7 of the last 8 elections, and that dismal record has some Republicans doing some serious rethinking, not about how to broaden the GOP's appeal to voters, but about how to take voters out of the equation. Republicans have an advantage in the Electoral College, which delivered George W. Bush in 2000 and Donald Trump in 2016 to the White House after they got fewer votes than their opponents. But that advantage proved insufficient this year. Joe Biden won enough states to carry the day. Trump and his allies insist he lost only because the election was stolen, a claim that has been summarily laughed out of several courts. Judges, you see, require actual evidence, which has been missing in action. But who needs the courts? There is a plan B. Get Republican-controlled state legislatures in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, and Georgia, all won by Biden, to replace the electors committed to him with a slate of their very own choosing that would vote for Trump. The idea was endorsed by one resident of the fever swamps of the right, radio host Mark Levin, who is to derangement what grass is to green. He tweeted a notice to Republican legislatures. You have the final say over the choosing of electors, commanding them to get ready to do your constitutional duty. Senator Lindsey Graham, RSC, indicated he was open to the idea. An unidentified Trump legal advisor raised the option with Barton Gellman of The Atlantic before the election. The excuse would be vote fraud, even though neither the courts nor state election officials have found any irregularities that would affect the outcome anywhere. The scenario sounds preposterous, but if we've learned anything from the past 4 years, it's that howling lunacy is no deal-breaker for Trump or his party. If flouting the will of voters is the only way to keep their desperate grip on the White House, it will get a respectful hearing. Many Americans don't realize that state legislatures once had this power and used it. The Constitution stipulates that each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. And in the early decades of the Republic, many state legislatures chose the electors. By 1832, every state but South Carolina assigned the task to voters. In its 2000 Bush versus Gore decision, though, the Supreme Court noted that a state can take back the power to appoint electors. But that retrograde option exists only in advance of an election. Legislators can't adopt a heads-we-win, tails-you-lose procedure. For a legislature to decide at this point to throw out the decision of its voters and substitute its own choices would be not only illegal but also unconstitutional. Under federal law, each state has to appoint its electors by election day. Any electors chosen afterward would be disqualified. Another federal statute says any change in the method of appointing electors must also occur before the election. The law doesn't allow do-overs. Even if the laws could be circumvented, this gambit would mutilate constitutional guarantees of due process and equal protection. When citizens of a state cast their ballots for president, they do so on the ironclad promise that their collective choice will govern. To renege on that promise would violate their rights. When the state legislature vests the right to vote for president in its people, the right to vote as the legislature has prescribed is fundamental, the Supreme Court said in 2000. The right of suffrage can be denied by a debasement or dilution of the weight of a citizen's vote, just as effectively as by wholly prohibiting the free exercise of the franchise. Even a Supreme Court as conservative as this one would be highly unlikely to approve such a brazen assault on democracy. In reality, no legislature is likely to moon its own people by overruling their judgment. To do so would be political suicide for at least some Republican lawmakers whose voters, after all, just confirmed their preference for a Democratic president. It would invite vengeance at the polls, and it would be futile because the courts would bury it 6 feet deep. By now, it should be clear that Trump failed in his re-election bid. If he pursues this option, He will only be devising one more way to be a loser. Stephen Chapman. Chapman writes for the Chicago Tribune as well as being a syndicated columnist. Find out more. Read Chapman's daily blog, www.chicagotribune.com/news/opinion/Chapman. Page 3 of the Odessa American for Tuesday, November 24th, 2020. Therapeutic Mentoring, OA News at OAOA.com. The Horse Center Incorporated, 2306 East County Road 140, Midland, has scheduled H2 Horses and Heroes Equine Peer Therapeutic Mentoring, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. each Wednesday. There is no charge for veterans and first responders. Equine Peer Therapeutic Mentoring Group is a non-traditional therapeutic approach to mental wellness. Call 634-8726 or visit tinyurl.com/y837LVVR. Stomach acids and COVID-19. Dear Dr. Roach, do we know if stomach acids or the bacteria in our intestines kill the COVID-19 virus? I am worried when I don't see people wearing gloves. DF. Answer. The vast majority of cases of COVID-19 come from inhaling infectious particles from a person with the virus, whether that person is symptomatic or not. The virus is inhaled into the lungs, where the infection progresses. Stomach acid and your intestinal bacteria are not effective at preventing infection, since the infection starts directly from inhaled particles. In theory, it is possible to become infected with SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, through the oral route, perhaps by touching an infected surface and then touching your mouth. However, this seems to be a rare way of acquiring the infection. Of course, gloves and careful hand hygiene are absolutely appropriate when taking care of a person with known COVID-19 infection. I sometimes see people wearing one pair of gloves all day, such as in the grocery store. This does nothing to help. Gloves should be worn during a risky encounter, then discarded and hands washed or disinfected. To your good health, Dr. Keith Roach. Roach's column appears Tuesdays through Saturdays. Readers may write him at P.O. Box 536-475, Orlando, Florida, 32853-6475. Death Notice. Sue Decker, Odessa. Sue Decker, 84, of Odessa, died Sunday, November 19th, 2020, in Odessa. Graveside service is scheduled for 2 p.m., November 23rd, 2020, at Cottonwood Cemetery. Arrangements are by Morrison Funeral Home of Graham. Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, November 24th, 2020. Obituaries. Santiago Suarez, Midland, August 18, 1976 to November 21, 2020. Some people don't believe in heroes, but they haven't met my dad. Zaitha Suarez affectionately bears the news of her dad's passing. The oldest daughter of Santiago Suarez sits at the table with her mom and family friends to recall some moments of her dad's life. Moments that, no matter how tenderly expressed, will still fall woefully short of his strength and compassion. Born of a small town in 1976, Santiago Suarez lived a life of big love for others. In Stanton, Texas, on the 18th of August, his 44 years began. He would leave a trail of all the blessings that generosity of spirit and the integrity and goodness of a man leaves. For a glimpse into Santiago's life incarnate, Psalm 91 reaches out with its reflections on the power of love to protect, rescue, and save. He is survived by his wife, Becky Suarez, daughters, Zaitha Suarez, Victoria Suarez, and Cheyenne Suarez, parents, Cosme and Soledad Primera, siblings, Homero Suarez and Noe Suarez. Santiago was preceded in death by his grandparents, Modesto Sanchez Bujanda and Alicia Payan Bujanda, as well as his aunt, Epifania Sanchez Bujanda, and his father, Santiago Suarez. Santiago also had nieces and nephews whom he loved dearly, Eleazar Suarez, Giselle Suarez, Homer Suarez Jr., Valentia Suarez, Noeli Suarez, Noe Suarez Jr., Alexi Gonzalez, Aiden Gonzalez, and Joshua Gonzalez Jr. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Midland Christian School Scholarship Fund if you wish to honor Santiago's memory. Visitation will be Monday, November 23rd, 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Rosary will be 7:30 p.m. on Monday, November 23rd, at the branch at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, located at 3800 North Big Spring. Funeral Mass will be on Tuesday, November 24th, at 10 a.m. at St. Stephen's Catholic Church, located at 4601 Neely Avenue. Burial will be at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Betty Lou Andrews Thomas, Odessa. Betty Lou Thomas broke her earthly bond peacefully at home and entered paradise on November 20th, 2020, in Odessa. She was a beloved wife, mother, and nana, and will be greatly missed until we are all united in heaven. Betty was a faithful member of Sherwood Church of Christ and loved her brothers and sisters in Christ. Betty was born on March 20th, 1927, to Joseph Melton and Edith Lucille Hensley Andrews in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Betty is preceded in death by her father, Joseph Melton Andrews, her mother, Edith Lucille Hensley Andrews, and numerous aunts, uncles, and cousins. Betty is survived by her husband, Bud Thomas, daughter Rodina and husband Carol Lawson, grandchildren Elizabeth and husband David Bell, Emily Smetak, Robert Lawson, Kelly Avery Brinley, Bethany and husband Mitchell Singleton, Logan Holden Michael. A graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, November 25th, 2020, at Sunset Memorial Gardens, with Lynn Money officiating. The family would like to give special thanks to Cynthia and Stephanie and for Olga for making her as beautiful in rest as she was in life. Rodina loved her mother dearly and took care of her for the last 4 years to ensure she was able to remain at home and with her family. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send condolences to the family, please sign her guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Henry Tito Reyes, Odessa. Henry Reyes, R-E-Y-E-S, 73, of Odessa, Texas, passed away on Wednesday, November 18th, 2020. Henry was born in McCamey, Texas, on June 1st, 1947, to Tomas Reyes and Jesusita Martinez. He was raised and attended school in McCamey. He married Irvenia Flores on February 12, 1973, through the Justice of the Peace, and then in St. Mary's Catholic Church on October 16, 1976. They were married for 46 years. Henry is survived by his wife, Ervenia Reyes, his daughters, Yvonne Reyes and Erica Reyes, and husband, Joey Martinez. Henry had 5 grandchildren, Ryan Nicholas Lancaster, Dylan Xavier Lancaster, Kari Dion Lancaster, Elena Sheehan Martinez, and Ezra Enrique Reyes Martinez. He is survived by his sisters, Celia Urias and husband Lupi Urias, Estella Esparza and husband Jimmy Esparza, Mary Ann Kilpatrick and Amelia Martinez, and by several nieces, nephews, godchildren, and other family and friends. Henry is preceded in death by his mother, Jesusita Martinez, and father, Tomas Reyes, his sisters, Petra Harmon, Mercy Galindo, Porfidia Gomez, Esther Cano, Maria, and brothers Lupi and Jose Baserto. Honorary pallbearers are Ezra Martinez, Elena Martinez, and Kari Lancaster. Joey Martinez, Ryan Lancaster, Dylan Lancaster will serve as pallbearers. The family of Henry Reyes wishes to thank Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home, St. Mary's Church, and Sunset Memorial Gardens for all arrangements and accommodations made during this difficult time. We would also like to thank Dr. Gibbons, Dr. Butler, and their wonderful staff for all of their help finding the best treatment plans for him. Visitation will be held on Tuesday, November 24th, 2020, from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home. Mass of a Christian burial will be held on Wednesday, November 25th, 2020, at 2 p.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial. Thank you to all of our family and friends who have reached out and sent many prayers and love our way. May God bless each and every one of you. This is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, November 24th, 2020, etc. Cranky friend at work may be threat to advancement. Dear Abby, I moved to town not long ago before the pandemic and don't have many close friends here. One of my best friends is a co-worker, Rana, whom I love dearly. Rana has had an extremely rough past, including an extensive history of parental abuse that has left her thin-skinned and suspicious of authority figures. Because of this, she's constantly butting heads with our management team and confronting them about perceived slights. While some of the points she makes are reasonable, many are taken too personally or blown way out of proportion, and she tends to act very dramatic, livid about it. I'm looking to move up in the company, and I'm torn between loyalty to my friend and the need to remain on good terms with our higher-ups. I'm also worried that my friendliness with management will lead to Rana resenting or distrusting me. How can I safely navigate it? In the middle in Colorado. There in the middle, do not involve yourself in Rana's problems on the job. If you do, they will spill over onto you. Maintain your personal relationship with her away from the office while networking and trying to widen your circle of friends. From what you have written, I doubt that Rana will be working for your employer much longer. Workers who react in a very dramatic, livid manner are usually laid off because their behavior is unprofessional and disruptive. Dear Abby, I am having problems with my baby dad helping me with our 2-year-old daughter. I don't like the idea of putting him on child support. I have tried counseling with him. In addition to asking him to step up, I have tried giving him lists of what our daughter needs, and he still isn't helping. Instead, he's asking me to help with his bills. I don't know what to do. I really don't want to go after child support since he now has 2 jobs. I need his help, but I don't know how to get him to contribute. Any ideas? Struggling mom in Ohio. Dear Mom, you have tried asking, You have tried counseling. The only option left to convince him to step up to the plate and fulfill his obligations as a father is to contact Child Support Services and ask for help. P.S. You absolutely should not pay his bills. Dear Abby, I have been asked by a close friend to officiate at his wedding. I'm honored to have been asked, and it would be easy for me to get the credentials, but I am not comfortable doing it for personal reasons. I know it's his special day, and he really wants me to do it. How can I politely decline without hurting our friendship? I don't know how to word my refusal. Not for me. Dear Not, be honest to the degree that you can be without causing hurt feelings. Explain that you are honored to have been asked to officiate, which is true, but would not be comfortable in that role, also true. Then deflect by offering to support your friend in some other way on his special day. Abigail Van Buren, write Dear Abby at P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Or visit www.dearabby.com. Appendicitis reveals potential cancer. Dear Dr. Roach, recently I had a sudden onset of appendicitis and was operated on the following day laparoscopically. The surgeon explained to me that the surgery took longer than usual because of scar tissue from a total hysterectomy 10 months earlier. He said my appendix was enlarged and inflamed around the site and had some samples sent for testing on the chance of cancer. This blindsided me. He said if I were positive for cancer, I would be sent to an appendix oncology surgeon. This was totally unexpected and very upsetting. The doctor said not to worry and that I would get the results in 2 weeks. Of course, I can't stop worrying. How common is this, and what is the likelihood of this coming to pass? I.B. Answer. Cancer of the appendix is very rare, found less than 1% of appendectomies. Sometimes all the cancer cells have been completely removed in the appendectomy, while other times further surgery is done to make sure the cancer is completely gone. Many experts recommend further surgery on all patients with appendix cancer, but this is debated. Abby wrote back to say the test result was negative for cancer and noted, I have always wondered if patients need to know in advance if cancer is a possibility or if the doctor should wait until tests come back and break the bad news only if that comes to pass. I'm not sure which way I lean. In general, I favor giving my patients as much information as possible, and while in this case there was some reason to suspect cancer was more likely, I don't feel telling people about a minuscule risk is helpful. It certainly leads to greater anxiety. I'm curious what readers think, and invite comments at my Facebook page, facebook.com/KeithRoachMD. That's KEITHROACHMD, or by email. To your good health, Dr. Keith Roach. Roach's column appears Tuesdays through Saturdays. Readers may write him at P.O. Box 536475, Orlando, Florida, 32853-6475.
Book Takes a Look at George H.W. Bush by Michael Bauer. George H.W. Bush lived in a lot of different places in his lifetime. The 41st president was born in Milton, Massachusetts, raised in Greenwich, Connecticut, and eventually made his way south to the Lone Star State. While Bush was widely hailed from Houston, his time spent in the Permian Basin area is something that played an important part in his life, according to author Charles Denyer. Denyer discusses Bush's time in West Texas with a biography titled Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James A. Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. The book, which talks about Bush's relationship with one of his closest friends and right-hand man, James Baker, will be released next month. Denyer, who lives in Austin, says that West Texas is where it all started for Bush and his family. Well, if you think about it, here's the man who came in from the East Coast and arrives with a unique vernacular, Denyer said. Cowboy boots, barbecue, and everything that was Texan was so foreign to him. West Texas truly was a whole new country for Bush. After graduating from Yale in 1948, Bush and his family moved to Odessa. He was transferred to Compton, California for a short time in 1949, before the family moved back to West Texas in 1950, to Midland. Coming in from the East Coast wasn't easy for Bush and his wife Barbara. However, Denyer said, the people in the Permian Basin embraced them and believed in them. He became a true Texan, not so much through Houston, but it started the Odessa-Midland area, Denyer said. Bush started off working as an oil field equipment salesman for Dresser Industries. In 1951, Bush and John Overby launched the Bush Overby Oil Development Company. In 1953, he co-founded the Zapata Petroleum Corporation. While living in the Permian Basin, the Bushes raised their family, including 43rd President George W. Bush, who was born in New Haven, Connecticut, in 1946, but attended public schools in Midland. Their sons John, Jeb, Neil, and Marvin were born in Midland. Their daughter Robin was born in California. In 1954, he was named president of the Zapata Offshore Company, which was a subsidiary that specialized in offshore drilling. In Denyer's book, he explained that Bush proclaimed 1954 to be a good year for Zapata, with the company holding a one-third interest in 70 wells and 100 more wells to drill in 1955. It wasn't until 1959 when the subsidiary became independent and Bush moved his family from Midland to Houston. Dorothy was born in Houston shortly after the transition. After becoming well acclimated in West Texas, Denyer explained that it wasn't an easy decision for the future president to pick up his family and move again, but that Bush knew what had to be done. Well, he was very comfortable in the Permian Basin, Denyer said, but he knew that he needed to be closer to the Gulf. So I think, personally, he agonized over it because he had been so accustomed to life in the Permian Basin. But he felt that he wanted to grow, and he wanted to grow his offshore company, and to do that he had to go to Houston. A passage from the book detailed Bush loved his life in Midland, but he acknowledged years later that Midland is nowhere near the Gulf of Mexico, where all our drilling rigs were operating. The rest is history. Bush would eventually venture into politics, serving as vice president under Ronald Reagan, before being elected president in 1988. His time as president saw a changing world, which included the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, and the end of the Cold War, as well as the Persian Gulf War, just to name a few. I don't know of any other president in modern time that's been faced with such a cascade of events over 48 months, Denyer said. Those events completely changed the world. All the events were absolutely monumental and consequential. Bush handled them, I think, with the utmost expertise that you would ever find with any commander-in-chief. As Denyer discusses in his book, Baker was by Bush's side throughout all of the events that transpired during his single term in office as commander-in-chief. Baker was heavily involved in the many policy decisions that the United States would ultimately take, Denyer said. The Berlin Wall, the fall of communism, Baker was there by Bush's side and helped make decisions that would help impact the entire world. However, Bush's time in Odessa, Midland, is something that shouldn't be overlooked, Denyer said. What he found in Odessa and Midland were normal people, and I think that really resonated with him, Denyer said. I think it set the tone for who he was as a human being. He was a normal person and humble. A lot of those traits were ingrained in him when he moved to Odessa. Texas Titans will be available in hardcover, paperback, and ebook formats wherever books are sold on November 17th. Latest economic forecast is for significant decline amid pandemic. The Economist by M. Ray Perriman. Our latest forecast update indicates significant declines in economic activity through 2020, despite a notable comeback from the dark days of spring, but a return to growth next year. In addition to the staggering and tragic human costs, the pandemic continues to curtail business activity. Even so, the economy, which was healthy going into the COVID-19 crisis, is signaling resilience and recovery potential. The U.S. job market continues to improve, but the pace of hiring is slowing. Total non-farm payroll employment rose by 661,000 in September, and the unemployment rate fell modestly to 7.9%. These improvements in the labor market reflect the continued resumption of economic activity that had been curtailed. Notable job gains occurred in leisure and hospitality, in retail trade, in health care and social assistance, and in professional and business services. Recent output numbers also indicate resilience in the economy. Real gross domestic product increased at an annualized rate of 33.1% in the third quarter of 2020, according to the advance estimate released by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, a significant rebound after falling dramatically in the second quarter. Our latest projections indicate real gross product losses of negative 3.17% this year on a year-over-year basis, with positive 3.44% growth in 2021. Job losses are projected to be negative 8.3 million through 2020, with a recovery of positive 6.8 million jobs next year. The previous peak job levels will likely reoccur in early 2022. Texas is projected to retrench a little more than the nation this year, but recover a little faster next year, due in part to the fact that the state's largest export sector, oil and gas, has been hit particularly hard. We are expecting Texas' real gross product to decline negative 4.27% this year on a year-over-year basis, with positive 4.04% growth in 2021. Job losses are projected to be nearly negative 549,000 through 2020, with a recovery of positive 315,400 jobs next year. For Texas' largest metropolitan areas, the decline in employment on a year-over-year basis for 2020 is projected to range from 3.34% in the Dallas-Plano-Irving area to 4.23% in the Houston, the Woodlands Sugar Land area. Recovery in 2021 is expected to be strongest in the Austin, Round Rock, Georgetown, Dallas, Plano-Irving, and San Antonio-New Braunfels areas. As I have said repeatedly since the pandemic began, the economic crisis is driven by a health crisis. The recovery is going to be uneven, and a new normal won't fully materialize until effective vaccines and/or treatments are widely available. As a result, there is far more uncertainty than usual surrounding our projections. If the recent surge in cases around the country compels significant interruptions in business activity, the recovery will be slower. In any case, Texas continues to be well-positioned for long-term expansion. Stay safe. M. Ray Perriman is president and CEO of the Perriman Group. Woman runs low on patience for friend's drama-filled life. Dear Abby for Thursday. Dear Abby, my friend Kate has had a lot of trauma in her life, and she feels things very deeply. She has experienced assault, the suicide of a close friend, the death of several family members, discovered she can't have children, and managed to escape an abusive relationship, all in the last 5 years or so. Kate does all the things people are supposed to do when coping with grief and is doing very well. The problem is me. I find it hard to be around her because of all the drama. Intellectually, I understand none of this is Kate's fault. She isn't being attention-seeking or deliberately causing drama. But I find myself becoming impatient with her ongoing discussion of feelings. I'm not someone who feels deeply or is easily traumatized. Bad things happen, I get over it and move on. How can I learn to be the patient, caring friend she needs? Trying to be a better friend. Dear Trying, quit being so hard on yourself. You are and have been a good friend. It's important that you not allow Kate's burdens to sink you. The two of you are very different people, and you should explain that to her as you have to me. If her trauma and drama become more than you can healthfully absorb, step back and tell her you will talk with her later, tomorrow or when it is convenient for you both, which will allow you time to come up for air. Dear Abby, I am self-quarantined for a number of reasons because of the virus. I'm 87 and live alone. My daughter is very concerned that I not become ill because her husband is in treatment for cancer. Obviously, she doesn't want to have to come care for me and endanger her husband's already reduced immunity. A friend called to ask how I am doing. I told her I was self-quarantined, and she asked if I needed anything. I told her I didn't have eggs, but it was no big deal. She said she would bring me some. I sent her a text and asked her to leave them on the porch, and she said, "You mean you won't let me in the house?" She said she isn't sick and can't understand why I'm doing this. I tried to explain that you can be contagious without symptoms, but she was still insulted. I thought everyone in the world knew the basics of quarantine, but apparently she's still taking it personally. She hasn't called for 3 days, and I'm heartsick. Advice? Shut in Arizona. Dear Shut In spite of the fact that the federal, state, and local governments are releasing information on a daily basis about the importance of social distancing and self-quarantining, there is still confusion in the minds of some of the public. Your friend is a perfect example of this. You are doing what you're doing for the right reason, and I hope you will continue, not only for your son-in-law's sake, but also for your own. Dear Abby, I've been married 5 years, and I just discovered that my husband still has several text messages from his late wife. He thinks I shouldn't be upset about it. Am I wrong for asking him to delete them? Feeling betrayed in the South. Dear feeling betrayed, yes, you are. Do not compete with a deceased spouse. Hanging on to mementos is a way many people grieve. If the texts hold significance for him, let him have them. You're his wife now, and that's what matters. Midlander's Company creates 2 new ranch water flavors by J.C. Lewis. Lone River Ranch Water has released 2 new flavors in time for the holiday season. Spicy Ranch Water and Rio Red Grapefruit Ranch Water are on grocery store and liquor store shelves now. Lone River's Spicy Ranch Water is the original ranch water recipe with a Texas kick. The West Texas Cocktail Classic is made with 100% organic agave, natural lime juice, and a hint of jalapeno. The Rio Red Grapefruit Ranch Water offers a different flavor profile with a Texas-sized squeeze of Rio Red Grapefruit Juice, 100% organic agave, and natural lime. Lone River Ranch Water was created by Midlander Katie Beal Brown, CEO of Lone River Beverage Company. The Ranch Water Seltzer is part of Brown's family gatherings and culture, she said in a previous MRT article. Brown said she started the company as a way to help tell the story of West Texas and its relationship to ranch water, which is a hard seltzer. All Lone River Ranch Water varieties, sold in a six-pack with a suggested retail price, $8.99, are available statewide at major retailers such as HEB, United Supermarkets, 7-Eleven, and independent stores throughout the state. For more information, visit LoneRiverBevCo.com. Walk-ons to open today. Walk-ons Sports Bistro, 4605 Whitman Drive, is having its grand opening today. The first 20 customers will receive a mini football autographed by Drew Brees, quarterback of the New Orleans Saints and the chain's co-owner. In addition, guests can enter a drawing for a chance to win free walk-ons for a year. Entries will be accepted during the Midland Restaurant's first full month of business. The winner will be announced the week of December 21st. Walk-ons, known for a Louisiana-inspired menu and game day atmosphere, will be open 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Sunday through Thursday and 11 a.m. to midnight Friday and Saturday. The restaurant's opening will kick off at 11 a.m. with a ribbon cutting by the Midland Chamber of Commerce. Restaurants open on Thanksgiving. Curbside Bistro at 3816 Andrews Highway in Odessa will be open from 11 a.m. to when food runs out. The lunch is free to anyone needing assistance. Cracker Barrel Old Country Store will be open 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. at 3108 North Loop 250 West. IHOP will be open on Thanksgiving with special pumpkin spice pancakes available. The restaurant's two locations are open 24 hours, 7 days a week. Saltgrass will be open for a dine-in turkey dinner from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 4511 Loop 250 Frontage Road. Buffalo Wild Wings will be open 3 p.m. to 2 a.m. at 5107 West Wadley Avenue. Carino's will be open noon to 6 p.m. at 711 Loop 250 Frontage Road. Starbucks locations will be open 4:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Whataburger open Thursday for 24 hours. Sister of Victim Continues Fight for Gun Reform by Caitlin Randall. Carla Burney never liked public speaking, and as an avid supporter of the Second Amendment, universal background checks and red flag laws weren't something she thought about until her younger brother, Joe Griffith, was killed along with six others by a gunman in Odessa last year. Now she's testified at several Texas House and Senate hearings asking legislators to enact common sense gun laws and has become one of the leaders of Moms Demand Action's Permian Basin chapter. Fighting for gun reform has become her life, she said in an interview with the Reporter Telegram. It's so tempting sometimes to just say, "Wouldn't it be nice to be done with this? Wouldn't it be nice to just have some peace, sit out on the back patio, watch the dogs run around, read my Kindle, have a glass of wine, and just let it go," she said. "And I'm tempted sometimes because it's such a heavy burden, and it would just be so much easier. But I can't. I can't because I look at my brother and look at how his life was just ripped from him. He had a life, and he was such a good, good man. And someone just took his life with zero care in the world. And Marcus Brazil gave him the gun to do that. And I can't stop. I won't stop." Brazil allegedly manufactured and sold the AR-style rifle used by Seth Ator to kill seven and injure 25 on August 31, 2019. According to a lawsuit filed Friday by Griffith's family and the family of 15-year-old Layla Hernandez, who was also killed in the shooting. Kentucky-based Anderson Manufacturing is also named as a defendant in the suit, which alleges the company was negligent in selling multiple firearms and gun parts to Brazil, who did not have a federal firearms license. The FBI and U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives raided Brazil's Lubbock home in September 2019, seizing 29 guns, according to media reports. Nearly a year later, no arrests have been made and the investigation is ongoing. The state of Texas allows private gun sales by unlicensed sellers. If firearms aren't being repeatedly bought and sold with a motive of turning a profit. As far as when selling guns crosses the line from a hobby to a business, ATF's guidelines are vague, making cases like Brazil's difficult to prosecute. We're highly concerned that the federal investigation will come to a standstill or that they will drop it, Bernie said. That's why Bernie and her family are hoping to hold Brazil and Anderson Manufacturing accountable in civil court, she said. More than receiving monetary relief, they want the lawsuit to put pressure on the Texas legislature. It's a long shot, but I am the kind of person that just because something is a long shot doesn't mean I'm going to just throw my hands up and not pursue it, Bernie said. Bernie, her sister, and parents have advocated for universal background checks. Ator is believed to have purchased a rifle from Brazil after failing a commercial background check because he had been committed to a mental health facility. Multiple polls have found that about 90% of Americans support universal background checks, including about 70% of National Rifle Association members. Bernie said those who don't will likely remain unmoved until they're personally touched by a mass shooting. As a school administrator, she said she would often get upset watching coverage of school shootings on the news, but didn't think she'd ever be affected by one. We all walk around thinking that we're immune, Bernie said. It's so arrogant, and I never knew how arrogant it was. We see tragedies all the time, and we think, that won't happen to me. We were just a regular family, going to work every day, contributing to society, trying to do a good job to help people, and it happened to us. None of us is immune. She said it's been a horrific year without her brother, who was ridiculously hilarious, so funny our faces would hurt from laughing, and would give you the shirt off his back. When she was 24 years old, Bernie said she moved to Los Angeles and was working at the mall while she waited to start a teaching job. After realizing she couldn't pay her rent, she called Griffith, who mailed her a check, without hesitation, despite being only 19 at the time. Griffith's family will spend Monday, the one-year mark of the shooting, playing golf, which he loved, Bernie said. He also loved Metallica and the Beatles and was a former seventh-grade math teacher with a wife and two children who were in the car when he was killed at a traffic light. Bernie was buying socks at a Target, Dallas, when she received the call from her sister that Griffith had been shot. Less than 2 hours later, she was waiting for her flight home when her sister called again to tell her that their brother had died. Bernie said she'll keep fighting for gun reform until those calls stop happening. I'm one girl in one town that hardly anybody knows exists, but I'm not just going to go home, turn the TV on, put my feet up, and pretend like this isn't happening every day, she said, because I just can't have another person get the call that I got. Even if one less person gets the call that their loved one's life has been stolen from them, even if one less person feels that, I have done what God has asked me to do. Collect Rainwater for Your Garden by Debbie Rowland, Master Gardener. Are you catching your rainwater for use in your yard, beds, or garden? Did you know that a 2,000-square-foot roof will yield approximately 1,200 gallons of water when we receive 1 inch of rain? This week, the local news reported that we may not get rain for several months, but it will rain again. This is the perfect time for you to install your own system. Rainwater harvesting is legal in Texas, and no permits are required. The state encourages it, and it is economically feasible. Installation and maintenance are sales tax exempt in Texas. The form needed is available on the controller's site. You print it, fill it out, and take it to the store. When you buy what you need, to set up a rainwater harvesting system. The state of Texas is predicting that our population will double in the next 50 years. The amount of water in lakes and underground aquifers is limited, and we all need to find alternative ways to water the property we are responsible for. Of course, when planning a landscape, use trees and plants that require the least amount of water possible. Next, when they do require water, make sure that you use only what is required. Rainwater is a perfect alternative to using city water or your water well, which lowers the water level in the aquifer. Rainwater is perfect for our plants since it contains no chemicals. I think we have all experienced what an inch of rain can do for our yards and gardens. A rainwater harvesting system can allow you to use that water not just once, but many times in the growing season. Rainwater can be stored in large and small barrels and above and below ground cisterns. Some are gravity-fed and do not require a pump. If you are eager to get started, you can learn more from Texas A&M AgriLife at rainwaterharvesting.tamu.edu. The Texas Water Development Board site has a Texas Rainwater Harvesting Guide available as well. For more information, call the AgriLife office at 498-4071 in Odessa or at 686-4700 in Midland, or visit aggie-horticulture@tamu.edu or westtexasgardening.org.
Dear Abby, condo community feels effects of stress during the pandemic. Dear Abby, my husband and I own a condo in a building with 22 units. Because of COVID, one of the HOA board members has posted signs stating rules throughout the building. The rules are typical for these trying times, but the number of signs is obsessive. Many of the residents dislike the signs, but my husband was the one who wrote a nasty letter to the HOA about how many are posted. The board member who was responsible for posting the signs was a friend of mine. Her feelings were hurt, and she has made some snide remarks about the letter. A group of women meet weekly for happy hour, and she and I are both part of that group. I feel caught in the middle. My husband has had a hard time getting over being mad about the signs, and I know the HOA member is angry at him. I just want to go to happy hour and drink and gossip. Why can't we all just get along? In the middle. Dear in the middle. We are living in trying times, and many people, your husband included, aren't their better selves right now. The HOA board was fulfilling its obligation to the community by posting health and safety signs. They are meant to educate not only homeowners but also visitors to the building, but too often they tend to become like wallpaper and are ignored. You are not caught in the middle. Your husband owes that woman an apology for getting snarky, but it probably won't happen unless you insist upon it. If it doesn't, you can always do it for him the next time you all meet for happy hour. Dear Abby, I met a wonderful man who was 14 years older who treated me like I have never been treated before. He opened doors for me, took me on actual dates, paid for things, met all my friends and family, and took me on my first vacation at 39 years old. He was very cuddly and such a gentleman. He even introduced himself as my boyfriend to some of my friends. 7 months ago, we had our first argument, and he asked me how I felt about him. I said I loved him, and he returned with, "I like you a lot." He said he didn't feel as strongly as I did and doesn't want a relationship. When we broke up shortly after that, he said he wanted to be friends, but he still called and invited me over for sex regularly for the next 6 weeks. I was very hurt, but I finally cut ties because emotionally I couldn't handle it. He still wants to be friends, but I cannot. He still will do anything for me and wants the benefits of being together without the labels. It has been more than 2 months, and I'm heartbroken. If I call him, he answers and talks like we are the best of friends, and it kills me. How do I get over him? Is it worth trying to see if we will work out? Broken in Utah. Dear Broken, this gentleman made clear that his feelings for you are not as strong as those you have for him.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.